Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Randy Fertel, whose new book is A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation. We'll also hear from Whitney Stewart, whose new picture book is Meditation is an Open Sky, Mindfulness for Kids. Randy Fertel is known for many things. His wonderful book about his parents, The Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak, a New Orleans classic, his vast knowledge of the literature of war, and his hard work founding the Ridenour Prizes in memory of his friend, the late great journalist Ron Ridenour. In his new book, he sets forth a fascinating way of looking at literature and life, too, called A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation. Randy, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, 40 years. You've been working on this book for 40 years. So talk about the very beginning.
Well, I was in this seminar at Harvard, and the guy started the class with just kind of a throwaway line. He said, it was this obscure Renaissance pamphlet by Thomas Nash. And he said, I bet you've never seen anything like this before. And it was like these doors opened in my mind. No, it's like Tristram Shandy, and it's like Byron's Don Juan. Luckily, I didn't say anything because I know they would have shut me down because Harvard's a nasty place. But I wrote a paper on it, and then I did it as a dissertation, and it was hard getting support for it because it didn't follow the usual methodology. You know, it wasn't just one tiny little idea, one tiny little period or couple poems by a certain poet. It's just all over the place. But I finally got a couple readers to sign on to it. So I knew it wasn't a young man's book because it takes on so much. And over the years, I just kept going back to it. And I found that whenever I got really excited about a poet or some art or something, eventually I would realize, oh, this fits. And so I would pursue that for a while, and it found its way into the book. The book is now kind of my memory bank. I mean, it now knows more than I do because I haven't retained all that stuff, but happily it's all in there.
It knows everything you've read, or a lot of what you've read over the years, that's for sure. So tell us what improvisation means to you, this appearance of effortlessness and spontaneity.
It's the appearance of, and that's the first thing it is. It's not... I don't care whether it's really improvised. So, for example, Jack Kerouac famously writes On the Road on a 120-foot scroll and always talks about it that way. But he then edited it for 6 years before it went into print. He never mentions the 6 years. What's important is, first of all, the claim, which brings you into this world of improv. And second, that it in form and style and theme tries to persuade you just not by claiming it, but by embodying this feeling of carelessness and inspired whatever, depending on what period you're in, it'll have a different kind of improv. But that's basically what it is. So I try not to play the Goldilocks game. I don't want to debate whether it's improv enough or too much or just right. Mm-hmm. Instead, ask the rhetorical question, why do they insist? And the amazing thing is that it just opens you up into this world where the typical mainstream values are thrown into question, like craft, rationality, carefulness,
prolonged study.
All those things that run our world. Mm-hmm. And this is a form of art that says, well, you know, that's good, but what if we broaden our perspective? You know, sometimes I think that it was kind of inevitable that the son of the Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak would write this because my mother was so analytic and, you know, she was a math science whiz. And my father probably never gave a second thought to anything.
Well, tell that story about reading the last line of The Great Gatsby to your mother.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, it's one of the great lines about, oh, God, I can't quote it.
But so we beat.
Please. So we beat against the current.
Yeah.
And I mentioned to my mother around the kitchen table, God, he must have worked so hard on this line. And she said, oh, no, he probably tossed it off. And, you know, later in graduate school, it was great to confirm that, you know, this is one of the great lines in American literature. But the interesting thing is that my mother, who was such a hard worker and would pore over her accounting and her invoices, she couldn't see art as something that you worked at.
Whoa. Now, you work very hard in this very long book. But there's one particular chapter where you work very hard to delineate the various aspects of improvisation. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, that's funny that one jumped out at you. I always thought that was a boring chapter, and then I reread it, and it's like, oh, this is kind of good.
Mm-hmm. It's very useful.
Yeah. So what I do is I give an anatomy or a taxonomy of all these different gestures that they use to convince us that it's improv. So first, I think I explore the different ways of claiming spontaneity. And then I talk about the different stylistic features and the different formal features, and then themes. So, you know, some of the formal features are open-endedness, which surprisingly is a way of embracing more. And that is ultimately the theme of improv, that it's urging us to embrace more of life.
Right.
And carpe vitam is my shorthand for that, the Latin phrase that I guess I made up, but playing on carpe diem, which means to seize the day, saying improv goes further than that. It says, no, let's seize all of life.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's a rhetorical gesture. You can't seize all. But improv is always, and here's one of the formal gestures they always use, they're always saying, listen, there's that, but we can do more. So, you know, I've been exploring ways to get this across to a general audience, and I remembered this ad when I was teaching in France, this magazine advertisement. One of my students pinned to my door because the kid in it looked just like me. And I was a Marlboro smoker back then, and this was a French ad for a new cigarette that was not for the beau cowboy. It wasn't for the pretty cowboys. And I started thinking, man, it's black and white, and it's kind of fuzzy photography. And so it's playing off against those pretty slick Marlboro ads.
Mm-hmm.
But Marlboro ads are thematically, not formally, but thematically related to improv because it's all about kind of the primitive, the natural, right? This isn't the cigarette for the civilized. It's for the cowboy, the rugged, you know. And so I wish I'd thought of this for the book. So Marlboro Man uses the themes of improv, but this new cigarette in France was taking it the next step and actually embracing this decorum of imperfection, which is at the heart of improv.
Now you draw, well, like this example from film, you draw not only on literature, but on music in this book.
It's a stretch for me because I'm not myself musical. I don't play a lick. But you know, I use John Cage, who explores music as a chance event. He had a composition, I think it's called 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds, where all that takes place is the pianist sits at the piano, opens it, and waits 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And the music is his opening the piano, the coughs in the audience, and like that. And I use a quote in there where he said, you know, I was leaving this museum and I was standing at the corner of 43rd Street and Madison Avenue. And I realized that my experience of looking at the sidewalk was as rich an aesthetic experience as art. And so what he's saying is that art is really an attitude. It's about alertness.
Yes.
It's about your eyes truly open to the world around you. And that's what improv is saying. That's how it urges you to embrace more. Thoreau says that the day only dawns to he who is awake to see it. And so that's what improv is urging us, to be awake.
Well, you have that great story about John Cage writing this piece of music inspired by the I Ching and throwing it every day on the subway for five years.
He had to throw it, I think, 8 times for each note or something. And so he would ride the subway because it took so much time. It took years to write this thing, completely aleatory, which means by chance. And I can't imagine what it sounded like. I'm afraid I didn't look it up. But then, you know, I also talk about Louis Armstrong, who's one of the great improv. He really created the jazz improv solo in jazz history. And you know, he figured also in my memoir, because he grew up three blocks from my grandmother, and he was kind of a counterpart, or he was kind of a counterexample to my father's life, because Lewis had nothing and had this joyous attitude, and my father had everything, and there was a bitter streak in my dad.
As you said, being the child of your parents prepared you to write this book. But there are certain things that strike me, just as an ordinary reader, about the fact that living in New Orleans uniquely prepared you to write this book. And there are certain things like the emphasis on jazz, the idea of bricolage, that gorgeous chapter on Hermes. That must have been so much fun to write.
That was a revelation when I realized that Hermes was kind of the embodiment of improv. And when I stumbled on this Homeric hymn to Hermes, it was just amazing how the poem itself is improv, and it embodies all the themes and that urge to unmediated experience, which improv is urging us to embrace. He's an interesting example of it, because he's the god who is the most immediate, but he doesn't have access to Zeus's mind the way Apollo does. So there's this rivalry between those two. And so he's kind of an example of, he stands for us in our longing for unmediated experience. You know, to, as the Bible says, to see not through a glass darkly, but face to face. And even he, a god, can't quite achieve that.
And I always think of him as the golden statue at the head of the one parade that rolls right on time, you know. Huh. And then, too, I thought of Larry Powell's book, The Accidental City.
Yeah.
Because so much of our civic life has been improvisation.
Well, you know, I was very moved by that theme in Larry's book. And my take on it is that, you know, it's the utopian city. It's the Cartesian city laid out on a grid. The first city in the New World laid out, or I think he says anywhere, laid out on a grid in these perfect squares. And being French and Cartesian, they put the center of that world, the Jackson Square, the Place d'Armes, which is the center of their universe, and the church. And if you follow that axis, what you come to is the perfectly irrational Congo Square.
Right.
And if you keep going, almost perfectly in line with that, is that, for me, nexus of power in New Orleans, that corner of Broad and Orleans, where my mother's restaurant was the place where political deals were made. And across the street is the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Club. And across the street from that is the F&F Botanica, the voodoo shop. So, you know, that tension between rational and irrational is embodied in our map.
Right. I swear, Randy, did it ever strike you as so terribly ironic it took 40 years to write a book about improvisation?
Oh, listen, you know, first of all, writing about spontaneity at Harvard was like living an oxymoron. And then, studying obsessively and analytically improvisation was a crazy kind of way.
Well, the other thing that made me think about was the end of Angels in America, you know, when Proctor steps forward, because that's such a play that's so improvisational and seems like just a normal conversation, long, long conversation. And then at the end of it, Proctor steps forward to the audience and goes, "What I wish for you is more life." And that's for the reader with this book.
That's what it's about. But, you know, I sat through both Angels. Was it two or three? Okay. Anyway, I saw them all in one day.
Oh, my God.
My God, did my tush hurt. but I guess I should look at that again. He's a Louisiana boy from Lake
Charles. Exactly. Yeah. But that's what I loved about this book, because it is so wide open and all-encompassing, and it's going to lead people to read favorite things in new ways, I think. I hope.
My favorite reader so far was this wonderful guy, Richard Rabinowitz, a American historian, and I asked him to read it because he's so smart and generous. And we sat down to talk about it, and he told me that as he read my book, when I would get to Milton's Paradise Lost, he went back and reread it. It was like he took it as an opportunity to do his great books course all over again.
Exactly.
But, you know, of course, I can't cover all of it, and my favorite moment when I have talked about this over the years would be when someone would say, yeah, but have you looked at this book?
Oh, of course.
And I've always thought, well, that's proof that I've got them, because they're basically saying, yeah, there's something here and I can think of other examples.
Right.
So I never argue with them.
Just as it was for you. Yeah. We've been talking with Randy Fertel, whose new book is A Taste for Chaos, The Art of Literary Improvisation. Randy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stewart has written many young adult biographies for young readers, including books about the Dalai Lama and Sir Edmund Hillary, but recently she's turned her attention to picture books. The last time we visited, it was to talk about A Catfish Tale, a bayou story of the fisherman and his wife. Now she's back with a lovely picture book, Meditation is an Open Sky, Mindfulness for Kids, with pictures by Sally Rippon. Whitney, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Nice to be here.
Now, I know you've been meditating for a long, long time. Can you think back to some of your earliest teachers?
My first teacher was when I was in high school, I took a yoga class. I had an injury, and the school let me take a yoga class, which was the very beginning of yoga. And I had these wonderful teachers, and I just fell in love with them. They were so calming. And meditation in that yoga class, we did a lot of meditation, really helped me with reducing the stress that I had when I was at boarding school.
Now, do you think beginning meditators always need teachers? Is it something you can teach yourself, or, I mean, what do you think?
That's a good question. I tried to teach myself meditation, but I didn't know very much about how to sit, what to do with my busy mind. So I think in my situation, I was very glad to have a teacher answer questions for me. However, these days, there are many books that can help a person who wants to start meditation. So there's instruction there. So I think you could start on your own. I had a difficult time back then because I didn't know where to begin. I didn't know what books to read. I didn't even know if there were books to read.
So when you take this book into a school, as I know you have, what kind of reaction do you get from the kids?
I love the reaction I get. I just took it this week, and I was working in some local schools, and I taught them a very simple meditation from the book. And then I asked the students afterwards, how do you feel? How was that experience for you? And one child said, peaceful. And another one said, really good. Another one said, I feel as if I'm melting. And these are all words that they use to describe a feeling of comfort that they had from just a very short meditation.
I'm sure the teachers were really grateful for that, don't you think?
Yeah.
It's like, come in, calm down, my class.
And we did this meditation before we went on to do something else. I was teaching them about writing stories. Mm-hmm. But we did this meditation just to help them settle and to focus and to calm their bodies. You know, they'd been out on the playground. They were bringing in their playground energy into the classroom. And we did this first. And then we turned later on to a more academic activity.
Maybe your next book will be teaching adults to have playground energy. Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be fun, actually.
So you have these two characters in this book, and the recurring characters in the illustrations, and they're an elephant and a monkey. Mm. And the monkey cracks me up, you know?
Yes, that's all Sally Rippon's doing. She's a brilliant illustrator, and I think sometimes she wanted to play off of this. If she were the monkey and I were the elephant, or she were the elephant and I were the monkey. And we teased each other in emails when she was working on this. But if you will look to see that the elephant is humphing when he's in a bad mood, or he's watching the monkey meditate and the elephant doesn't really know what to do, so the elephant has his eyes open, peeking at the monkey to see, you know, how do I do this? How do I meditate? Which is really great.
Oh, it's so much fun to look at. For adults, it's that kind of detail.
Mm-hmm.
that charms.
I think children will notice that detail as well.
Yes.
And I notice when I'm teaching meditation that if I ask the students to close their eyes, I tell them they can do either. But sometimes we start with eyes closed, and there are always a few kids that are peeking, looking to see what everybody else is doing.
Well, we all know what monkey mind is. That's one of those expressions that's just perfect for what it is. Now, this book is structured around useful meditations. Things like friendship meditation for kindness when a friend needs joy, or bursting emotion for control. If you're mad or upset, you try this meditation before you act out. So how did you come up with all those situations?
I tried to think of emotions that I have that I want to know how to work with. And I also think about, I raised a child, so I tried to remember those issues that my child had. And these are universal emotions. You know, anger, of course, we all experience anger sometime in our life. And most of us don't like having the feeling of anger. And we act out. And sometimes we act out in ways that we wish we hadn't. We say something nasty, or we hurt ourselves, or we physically act out and hurt somebody else, or we, you know, we stomp our hand on something and that hurts. And this meditation is really to help you look at your anger and not react to it, to notice it where it goes in your body. How do you feel? Does your heart beat faster? Do your hands sweat? Do you make fists? Do you want to lash out verbally? And look at all your impulses to do that. And before you actually react, to take a moment and to practice this meditation technique, and then give yourself a pause, a gap, before you respond. And you can then respond constructively to your anger. You might have a legitimate reason to have that anger. Maybe there's a conflict and you feel a sense of injustice. However, reacting to that anger and hurtfully towards someone else is not usually the best response. So if you calm down, give yourself a pause, you may find a better response.
Now, you know, Whitney, I've known you for many, many years, and I don't think I've ever seen you be angry. I can't even imagine you angry.
So. Oh, well, just ask my husband and my son.
That's reassuring. So
yes, I do get angry.
Now, I love it that so many schools now are making meditation part of their curriculum, that they do use it with students. Mm-hmm. Are you finding that as you travel around with this book?
Yes, I am. And there are so many studies now that show that meditation can help with impulse control, that destructive emotions, it helps students focus, reduce their stress. There's no doubt from these studies that there are benefits from meditation in the classroom. Therefore, more and more schools are learning about this and implementing mindfulness meditation in their classrooms.
And what was it like for you to go back to the very basics? Was that kind of a clarifying experience for you of to try and explain anything to a child? I think is such a challenge.
You know, there are 9 attitudinal factors of mindfulness, according to a great mindfulness instructor, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who I admire. Mm-hmm. And one of those attitudes is to have a beginner's mind.
Ah, yes.
So this is important for me. It was very important for me to write this, because how do I look at myself as a beginner? And what do we all need? And I use these techniques myself. So they're not simple. They're not basic. They're not like, oh, well, you know, later on you'll get the real stuff. This is the real stuff.
Ah, and you meditate every day, don't you?
I do. And I don't meditate on a regular schedule of always at 7 o'clock in the morning or always at 10 o'clock at night. I vary it depending on my schedule. But I tend to meditate throughout the day. So I'll meditate 5 minutes here, 20 minutes there, another 20 minutes. You know, it really depends on my day.
Well, I hope lots of kids read this wonderful book. We've been talking with Whitney Stewart, whose new book is Meditation is an Open Sky, Mindfulness for Kids, but it's good for the kid and all of us. Thank you so much, Whitney.
Thanks, Susan.
I love songs about reading and books. They're the musical equivalent of a comfy chair with a good lamp. The Bookstore Man by the Holstein United Bluegrass Boys celebrates the life of a bookseller.
Early morning silence was all the bookstore man could hear. Even though he knew he could fall, there was not a thing he'd fear while being here. Right before the snort of his hound left his dreaming den, the bookstore man awoke with a sound that made his dog turn its head to look around. He knew a day was never better than the mind that fueled his pace, and a great idea could fetter any trouble he might face. Breakfast with his trusty cassette, a newspaper or two, the bookstore man just knew he would let this day amount fed a latest goods review. And turning round the key to his car, a wooden panel fame, the bookstore man left thoughts wide ajar while shutting close the door to pass a claim. He knew a day was never better than the mind that fueled his pace, and a great idea could fetter any drug.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Bloodjet Poetry Series hosts Chris Shipman and Brett Evans, reading from and signing T-Rex Parade, Wednesday, April 1st at 8 at BJ's, 4301 Burgundy. Dale Curry signs and serves samples from her new cookbook, Gumbo, Saturday, April 4th at 11:30 a.m. at Maple Street Bookshop's Spring Celebration with Gumbo and Snowballs. Alexander McConduit signs Snowballs for All, and Melissa Wallace signs It's Great to Be a NOLA Kid, Saturday, April 4th at 11:30 as well at Maple Street Bookshop. Poet Juliet Sirpizera reads from her work, followed by an open mic Sunday, April 5th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Mike Corrado signs his children's picture book, Little Elliot, Big City, winner of the 2015 Ezra Jack Keats New Illustrator Book Award honor, Tuesday, April 7th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses An Unnecessary Woman by Rabbi Alameddine, Tuesday, April 7th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. New members are welcome. And Katie Simpson-Smith, author of We Have Raised All of You and The Story of Land and Sea, is the featured reader at the 1718 Reading Series, Tuesday, April 7th at 7 at the Collins Hotel. Coming up, the 12th Annual Jambalaya Writers Festival takes place Saturday, April 11th at the Terrebonne Parish Library. Wally Lam, author of She's Come Undone, I Know This Much Is True, The Hour I First Believed, and many other works, will be the keynote speaker. This event takes place at the Terrebonne Parish Main Library, 151 Library Drive in Houma. For more information, email Lauren Bordelon at lauren@mytpl.org or check out mytpl.org/JWC. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.